The possible existence of some sort of strange extraterrestrial animals has been remotely considered, as many of the objects described acted more like animals than anything else. However, there are few reliable reports on extraterrestrial animals. All of the information so far presented in Project Saucer on the possible existence of spaceships from another planet propelled by an advanced type of automatic power plane has been largely conjecture. To sum up, no definite conclusive evidence is yet available that would prove or disprove the possibility that a portion of the unidentified objects are real aircraft of unknown or unconventional configuration. Many sightings by qualified and apparently reliable witnesses have been reported. However, each incident has unsatisfactory features, such as the shortness of time the object was under observation, the great distance from the observer, vagueness of description or photographs, inconsistencies between individual observers, lack of descriptive data, etc. Insofar as the aerodynamic superiority of the disc-like phenomena is concerned, the circular platform has not been used in representative aircraft, either military or civilian, because the induced drag is excessively high. Spherical or balloon-shaped objects are also usually considered as efficient aircraft. Drag is high and the energy expended to develop life by aerodynamic means is excessive. The obvious explanation for most of the spherical-shaped objects reported, as already mentioned, is that they are meteorological or similar type balloons. This, however, does not explain reports that they travel at high speed or maneuver rapidly. But saucer men point out that the movement could be explained away as an optical illusion or actual acceleration of the balloon caused by gas leak and later exaggerated by observers. There are scores of possible explanations for the sources of different type sightings reported. Many of the aerial phenomena have been positively identified. However, the correct tagging of the remaining percentage is still the job of Project Saucer. The saucers are not a joke. Neither are they a cause for alarm to the population. Many of the incidents already have answers. Meteors. Balloons. Falling stars. Birds in flight. Testing devices, etc. Some of them still end in question marks. It is the mission of the AMC Technical Intelligence Division's Project Saucer to apply the periods. This ends the official report by Project Saucer. But pertinent to it are the following two items. From the June 5, 1949 issue of Walter Winchell's column Up and Down Broadway. The NY World Telegram has confirmed this reporter's exclusive report of several weeks before, which newspapermen have denied, about the flying saucers, said the front page in the WT. Air Force people are convinced the flying disc is real. The clincher came when the Air Force got a picture recently of three discs flying in formation over Stephensville, Newfoundland, the great transatlantic air base. They outdistanced our fastest ships. Some Air Force men believe the discs are a new flying machine utilizing gyroscopic principles. From the May 14, 1949 issue of the Washington Daily News. Some Air Force men think they know what those flying discs are and where they came from. They believe discs are new type flying machine utilizing gyroscopic principle, but they come from Spain. They say Nazi scientists, known to have been working on gyroscopic flight during war, dropped from sight after row with Hitler. Intelligence reports hint they escaped to Spain. Captured documents indicate Germans had gone further than any with use of gyroscopic principles for flight. Air Force people are convinced flying disc is real. They say it is not produced in this country. They feel sure it is not produced in Russia. Clincher came when Air Force got picture recently of three discs flying in formation over Stephensville, Newfoundland. Not close up, because they outdistanced our fastest ships, but close enough to be convincing. Chapter 7. Comments on the Project Saucer Report. In reading the fabulous report of Project Saucer, it is necessary to bear in mind several pertinent facts. First is that apparently the armed forces do not let their left hand know what their right hand is doing. Thus, on precisely the same day that the Wright Field Air Materiel Command treated the saucers seriously, and declared they were no joke, and in effect, admitted that they existed beyond all doubt, but that their nature was undetermined. Intelligence was busy cooking up a two-part article in the Saturday Evening Post, presumably authored by Sidney A. Shorlett, which was designed to poo-poo the whole business and laugh it all away. The first portion of this article appeared simultaneously with the Wright Field report, and the impact of an official report placed against the heresy of the Post article did little to enhance the reputation of either the Post or author, Sidney Shorlett. It would be quite impossible for Shorlett to look anything but sheepish in the face of such a ringing denunciation. Lest the statement just made be denied, I quote here a letter signed by Alethea Redfern, secretary to the Director of Intelligence, and addressed to Mrs. Velma Brown, wife of Frank M. Brown, the flyer killed in the Tacoma affair. This is a personal letter, not written on official stationery, and no caution us given to refrain from quoting the letter so no confidence is being violated. I will try to give you the colonels, Colonel Donald L. Springer, in command of the 4th Air Force, Hamilton Field, California, viewpoint concerning any articles written about the flying saucers. There have been several magazines published in Chicago, bordering on the sensational and fantastic, which dealt with the flying saucers or flying discs. None of them are authentic but deal only in conjecture and imagination. You are at liberty to say anything you wish concerning the discs, but the Colonel cautions you to base every remark on absolute fact and to be able to substantiate anything you say. You might be required to prove your statements unless you state definitely that you are only assuming, or that you believe, etc. There was recently published in the Saturday Evening Post a very good article about the discs released by the Air Force. Confirmation of this fact was secured by Ray Palmer, who spoke personally to Stuart Rouse, one of the editors of the Post, who seemed unwilling to discuss the matter after being tricked into admitting the Air Force officers parked all over his office has done little else but annoy him. It is interesting to note that the Army investigated reports 6 months before the saucers became headline news. Obviously, then, before the public ever heard of them. Also, the employment of Professor Joseph A. Harnack indicates the seriousness with which saucer investigation was being made. When statement is made that certain inconsistencies exist in Arnold's estimates of size, speed, and performance of his saucers, it is noted that these inconsistencies are not listed. Worse, a definite attempt to insert a false note is contained in the statement that whatever objects were observed were traveling at subsonic speeds and may therefore have been some sort of known aircraft. There is only one word to describe that statement: it's deliberately false. In commenting on the Gorman incident, Project Saucer has this to say: from a psychological aspect, the Gorman incident raised the question, is it possible for an object without appreciable shape or known aeronautical configuration to appear to travel at variable speeds and maneuver intelligently? Note the keywords in this clever little brushing aside of the whole matter: psychological. A slap at Gorman's psychic tendencies. Possible. A complete evasion of the fact that the thing was not only possible, but did travel as described. Appear. In other words, actually the object didn't do what Gorman said it did, it only appeared to. Project Saucer makes no other comment, except this one, which is designed to cause the casual reader to conclude that Gorman was slightly balmy and Project Saucer was just being polite in not putting it bluntly. However, pop-eyed with its knowledge of the amazing facts about flying saucers, Project Saucer cannot refrain, in its report, from including numbers of sightings which are apparently authentic, and which they admit cannot be explained. Why they select the Arnold and Gorman reports for special, and biased, reproach is a mystery. Why not be fair all around? Then, to make the authentic instances fall into the same fairy tale category, by association, they quote instances which, even to the most casual citizen, are patently frauds, and should not even be considered. I wouldn't require Drive Harnack to classify these instances for the junk file. Most asinine comment is made on the Camp Springs, MD, incident, which is labeled as the most startling. Let's quote it: "The mystery was cleared up when the object was positively identified as a cluster of cosmic ray balloons. Nothing more. Just that." Yet it alternated 80 to 500 or 600 miles per hour and took evasive action. A single object. Allow us a solution of our own. It was a grain of puffed rice, shot too enthusiastically from a gun by the makers of breakfast cereal. And if such sarcastic remarks injure the feelings of Project Saucer, may we point out that they are not original, but only typical of the many snide references to our mental health, eyesight, physical health, powers of observation, imagination, childishness, etc. made in public pronouncements and official releases regarding saucers? And now we come to the biggest tempest, the hoax stirred up by Fred Crisman and Harold A. Dahl at Tacoma, Washington. First, the statement is made by Project Saucer that Crisman and Dahl broke later under questioning and admitted that the fragments were unusual rock formations found on Maury Island and had no connection with flying discs. It also said that the pair admitted telling the Chicago magazine that the fragments could have come from the discs in order to increase the sale value of their story. It further said that during the investigation, Dahl's wife consistently urged him to admit that the entire affair was a hoax. When Fate magazine, Evanston, Illinois, published the report made public by Project Saucer, Fred Crisman wrote a letter to the editor, threatening to sue unless the above false statements were retracted. They were not retracted, of course, because they were official releases by Project Saucer. But whether they were false or not should rest on other and more positive factors. These factors follow. If the fragments were unusual rock fragments found on Maury Island, or as another official news release from Colonel Springer of Hamilton Field stated were natural rock formations found all up and down the West Coast, then Major Sander of S2 Army Intelligence at McCord Field in Tacoma was trying to create a false impression when he showed Captain Smith and Kenneth Arnold the slag pile in a local smelter dump and insisted this was the actual source of the fragments he so carefully did not permit them to retain. Crisman and Dahl did not submit the fragments to the Chicago magazine in an effort to sell a story. They never asked for any money for the fragments, nor did they submit a story, only an explanatory letter. There can be no doubt about that, since Ray Palmer, one of the authors of this book, was the editor to whom the fragments were sent and the editor of the Chicago magazine Project Saucer mentions. That either man confessed to a hoax is the least proven item in Project Saucer's statement. Today neither of these men can be found, having mysteriously disappeared. In the case of Dahl, he left a home, a business, and apparently all his interests, unclaimed. But let science itself have a word to say here about the fragments from the particular slag piles pointed out by Major Sander. Let the reader decide for himself if they are identical. Of if either one is a natural rock. Analysis of original fragments: high constituents, calcium, iron, zinc, titanium. Middle constituents, aluminium, manganese, copper, magnesium, silicon. Low constituents, nickel, lead, strontium, chromium. Traces, silver, tin, cadmium. Nothing of an unusual nature exists in this combination except the unusually high quantity of calcium and titanium. It is interesting to note that titanium, one of the high constituent metals, is now believed to be the key metal in constructing missiles or ships capable of space travel. Also, calcium has an affinity for particles of radium, and the ability to capture them and prevent contamination of surrounding areas. Analysis of Tacoma slag fragments. 1. The crude sample is magnetic. This indicates the presence of the mineral magnetite, iron oxide, Fe3O4, free iron ore both. Both appear to be present in this sample. 2. About 21% of the sample is soluble in hydrochloric acid. This is the iron-iron oxide fraction. The acid-insoluble fractions are obviously different chemical individuals, Both fractions were analyzed separately. 3. The acid-soluble fraction is 49.7% Fe, iron. Qualitative tests showed a small amount of Zn, zinc, a trace of Cd, cadmium, anmo, molybdenum. No nickel, cobalt or copper are found in this fraction. The remainder of this sample is largely oxygen. 4. The acid-insoluble fraction has the following analysis. Percent CO2 49.2. Percent Fe2O3 30.2. Percent Fe 21.2. Percent Carbao 13.1. Percent Car and Bar 9.35. Percent O 1.1. Percent Mn 0.87. The remainder of the material is aluminium, titanium, magnesium and alkali oxides together with small amounts of other metals. No cobalt or nickel were found in this fraction. 5. A mineralogical analysis under the petrographic microscope shows that the sample is a very complex mixture of silicates and oxides, typical of an artificial slag. On the basis of the above 5 points, the material is slag from the production of steel. The presence of appreciable amounts of iron in the slag suggests that it is slag from an open hearth furnace. The structure of the material and the fact that it contains no cobalt or nickel eliminate the possibility that the sample is of meteoric origin. The structure and presence of free iron and magnetite make it very unlikely that the material is a natural lava. And there we have it. The samples first sent by Crisman and Dahl were not slag nor were they natural rock. What were they? If the take-home affair was not a hoax, then they were portions of a flying disc. Now let us examine the strange facts discernible in Ken Arnold's story of his adventure at Tacoma. When Arnold arrived at Barry's airport, he kept his identity secret. Also, no possibility existed that anyone in Tacoma could have known he was coming. Yet when he tried to get a room in the town, where rooms were practically impossible to get, he found that one had been reserved for him at the Hotel Winthrop, reserved in the name of Kenneth Arnold. Who reserved it? Another Kenneth Arnold? If so, he never showed up to claim his room. Reaching Mr. Dahl by phone, his initial reaction was to advise Mr. Arnold to go home and forget the whole business. His reason for this advice was based on superstition which seemed highly illogical in a man of the physical proportions of Mr. Dahl. Later, in the hotel room, Dahl, who had a story to tell, did no talking at first, allowing Arnold to take the lead, and then, instead of telling his story, again urged Arnold to go home. Then, making as if to leave, he made it an implied threat. But Arnold was not to be scared out, and insisted on the story he had come to get. Only after every attempt to get him to leave had failed did Dahl comply. And Dahl was the man who had already told that story to Ray Palmer via the mail, in Chicago, even sending a cigar box full of fragments to back it up. Here was Ray Palmer's personal representative, and he went to great lengths to kill the story. All during the stay in room 502, Ted Morello and Paul Lance at the Tacoma Times were receiving phone calls from a mysterious informant who repeated verbatim conversations that were going on in the room, even when Crisman and Dahl were in the room. There is only one way that could have been done. The room was wired for sound. It was cleverly wired, too, for no portable installation could be found by Smith and Arnold, though they made a thorough search for one. It was the sort of installation that would require cooperation on the part of the hotel, or would use highly technical and expensive equipment such as it is rumored Secret Service organizations possess. After telling his story, Dahl again attempted melodramatically to scare Arnold out. He wrung his hands, told Arnold of the stranger who had been able to recount Harold's entire adventure as though he had been present. How? The next morning, and had inferred he'd witnessed something he shouldn't have, and that if he loved his family he would not discuss it with anyone. But unafraid, he had promptly reported the matter to an editor of a magazine. Now, however, he is terribly afraid, not to tell still another person, but for the welfare of that person. Yet, when Arnold suggested to bring in still another person, Captain Smith, he did not object in the least. Both Chrisman and Dahl were in hearty accord with this idea. Further, when it was suggested that Army Air Force Intelligence be called in, Chrisman was almost enthusiastic. Right there is where any pair of hoaxers would have begun backpedaling mightily. These new developments would have spelled trouble in big letters. No matter how Arnold and Smith tried, they could never get to the crux of the situation, getting out of Maury Island and seeing the 20 tons of fragments with their own eyes, or getting to see the pictures Dahl had taken which supposedly show the saucers clearly, though the negative was spotted as though by exposure to X-rays. The negatives were always somewhere else, finally up in the hills in a remote cabin. Sometime in the course of talks with Chrisman and Dahl, it is suggested that the fragments brought to the hotel room seemed curved, and might be parts of the lining of a jet or tube about 6 feet in diameter. Sure enough, when lined up, they do bear this out. Yet there were scattered fragments, only a few among thousands, only a few pounds of a total of over 20 tons. Peculiar indeed, when you think about it, that they should be related fragments. But then the white metal turns out to be perfectly familiar, and Chrisman and Dahl, at least one, Chrisman, a former Air Force pilot, with a good record in Burma, would know that it would be familiar, recognizable to Arnold and Smith as portions of military aircraft gone to the salvage dump. Now we aren't trying to scare anybody out, we are trying to make it obvious that we are pulling a hoax so Arnold and Smith will leave in disgust and so report the incident to Ray Palmer. When the intelligence men arrived, Brown saw Arnold alone, showed him drawings of what he said were authentic pictures of flying saucers, and was very cooperative. Later, when they should really have been excited, after Chrisman had been around long enough to get his story across, both intelligence men dropped interest as though it were a dead fish, and left in high gear. They did not even intend to take any of the important fragments, until Chrisman, dashing away, came panting up with a whole boxful and literally forced them upon the intelligence men. Only they aren't the same kind of fragments. Now, suddenly, Ted Morlow becomes very solicitous for the welfare of Smith and Arnold. He pleads with them. They ought to go home. But he hasn't a very good reason. Next morning, Chrisman phones, this time with information that is enough to scare anybody out of town. Brown and Davidson are dead. Their plane has crashed. Brother, they'll be hell to pay, explaining to Uncle Sam how you happened to get two of his best men killed and a very expensive plane wrecked. Why, this little hoax might well land everybody in jail. In an inspection of the harbor patrol boat, it is obviously not a harbor patrol boat. The repairs are not as extensive as Chrisman had given them to understand. The excuse of working on the motor turns out to be false, not a nut has been turned on it. The craft itself appears extremely unseaworthy. And it develops Chrisman knew Ray Palmer, and lies when he tries to explain it. Actually all his acquaintance with Palmer amounted to was a very grim letter warning the editor to lay off what was then known as the Shaver Mystery, a secret underground menace, in which a fantastic story was told by Chrisman of being in a cave in Burma in search of this underground menace and being raided by an unseen being and having a hole the size of a dime burned in his arm. Our letter from Palmer believed not at all. Yet, when Chrisman talked to Palmer on the phone that night of August 1st, from Tacoma, Palmer recognized the voice as one he'd heard before over other phones, always from different portions of the country, always with a fantastic story designed to get him to lay off the Shaver Mystery. Then finally, Chrisman vanishes from the scene, aboard an army bomber, bound for Alaska. A flight no civilian could have boarded. Earlier, when a visit is paid to the house where Dahl first showed Arnold the fragments, it is deserted and cobwebbed. Dahl has never been seen since, although Arnold has tried several times to find him. Neither is Chrisman to be found in Tacoma, although, reputedly, both men had good prospects there, being interested in logging and lumber operations, even having several $5,000 deals pending. Was the Tacoma affair a hoax? Whose? Who was in a position to know the contents of Kenneth Arnold and Ray Palmer's mail? Who made the reservation for Kenneth at the Winthrop? (1) 1. In the original document, this was incorrectly identified as the Windsor. Yes, who? There is only one thing the Tacoma affair proves: the sources are very real indeed. Important enough to go to a lot of trouble to scare out the only two men doing any serious investigation of an unofficial nature. Project Saucer states that with few exceptions, all disc sightings have been limited to the continental limits of the United States. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Hundreds of authenticated sightings are listed, quite a few of them reproduced in this book. One prize statement is the following: there are few reliable reports on extraterrestrial animals, but those few, gentlemen, those few, where did you get them? Are they well substantiated? Can you prove them? Are they as real as flying saucers? P.T. Barnum would love you. But in one instance we can agree heartily with Project Saucer's voluminous report: the flying saucers are not a joke. Chapter 8. 1,000 years of flying saucers. Flying saucers, if they are interplanetary machines, have been looking over this green spinning globe not for years but for centuries. This is proven by extensive research into the archives of the British Royal Society dating back 288 years, from medical chroniclers, from 17th century astronomers' ephemerides, English, German, Hollander, French and Italian, from old magazines in a day when none but the wealthy reader or wrote for such journals, and from very rare volumes in Latin or other modern tongues. In the 16th, 17th and especially the 18th century, many of these strange spectacles took the form of surprising lights. These were definitively not the Aurora Borealis, which was well known to astronomers and northern people then as now. These phenomena often took the form of burning streams of light. Such lights were seen over London in 1560 and 1564, and over Brabant, in what is now Belgium, in 1575, when a professor of medicine, Cornelius Gamma of the University of Leuven, described them. Often the lights were so powerful that one could see the smallest pin or screw on the ground by their powerful illumination. They seemed to be extremely powerful searchlights, projected from the skies to the ground. In the year 1773 comes the first report of the appearance of one of those gleaming aluminium-like bodies that in 1946-50 were called flying saucers. In broad daylight on December 8, 1733, a Mr. Cracker of Fleet, a small township in Dorset, England, was startled to see, as he says, something in the sky which appeared in the north, but vanished from my sight, as it was intercepted by trees, from my vision. I was standing in a valley. The weather was warm, and sun shone brightly. On a sudden it reappeared, darting in and out of my sight with an amazing coruscation. The color of this phenomenon was like burnished, or new washed silver. It shot with speed like a star falling in the night. But it had a body much larger and a train longer than any shooting star I have seen. At my coming home, one Brown told me that there body and the train seemed 20 feet long. Next day, Mr. Edgecombe informed me that he and another gentleman had seen this strange phenomenon at the same time as I had. It was about 15 miles from where I saw it, and steering a course from E to N. Another of these cosmic visitants took the form of a slender pyramid. It was seen about 15 minutes after sunset on April 3, 1707. I was perpendicular to the horizon, of musty red color, and visible for an hour. I have never seen anything like it, said the observer, a parson named Durham, fellow of the Royal Society. A mysterious object shaped like a trumpet appeared on three occasions in the English skies -1710, 1744 and 1745. It was seen first on May 18, 1710 by Ralph Thoresby, F.R.S., over Leeds, Yorkshire, at 9:45 p.m. A queer apparition like a trumpet, with a broad end. It moved north to south, with the broad end foremost. As it moved, it emitted light. People were startled to see their own shadows with no moon or sun in the sky. It was seen from three other countries. The same or similar cosmic machine was seen, 34 years later, on May 27, at 11:11 p.m., by Henry Baker, FRS, who reported,